Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
This evening, we're going to be meeting with Dr. James A. Underberg, founder and president of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. There is a difference in men and women regarding heart disease. Also, women need to pay special attention to this disease after menopause. Stay with us to learn how to avoid obesity, control fat, and live a longer, healthy life. Good evening, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Medical College, Cornell University, and New York Presbyterian Hospital. I am delighted to be with Dr. James A. Underberg, Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine at NYU Medical School. Most importantly, he is founder and president of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. It is a great honor and a pleasure to have Dr. Underberg with us because I hope throughout the evening he's going to highlight the importance of controlling your blood cholesterol and lipids and also the role of hypertension in heart disease and stroke. Dr. Underberg, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Jim, the topic or the name preventive cardiovascular medicine. Until I was researching you, I hadn't heard of it. Explain to us, what is that?
Well, it is an old and new and an emerging field all in one. Preventive cardiovascular medicine, stated simply, is the prevention of cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease, though, is a very broad topic. And cardio refers to the heart, but vascular is the vascular system, which extends completely throughout our body. So what we try and do in this discipline is prevent both heart disease and vascular disease of every other part of the body, meaning disease that leads to stroke, disease that leads to kidney disease, eye disease, and peripheral vascular disease or disease of the extremities. There are different types of prevention. There's primary prevention and there's secondary prevention. Primary prevention is the prevention of disease before it occurs, meaning treating risk factors so that people don't get heart attack or stroke or kidney disease. Secondary disease is the prevention once these things occur to prevent their progression or prevent another event. If someone, say, had a heart attack, we would then want to institute secondary prevention to try to prevent another heart attack or, say, a stroke.
How does this work in your group, which I presume practices preventive cardiovascular medicine? You know, you're an internist, so you're a heart specialist. Mm-hmm. Person starts having stroke-like symptoms or transient ischemic attacks, or a person starts having kidney problems. Do you manage those, or are there people within your group that specialize in kidney disease and brain disease, and they work with you?
Well, again, the interesting thing about preventive cardiovascular medicine is it encompasses a lot of disciplines. And so a cardiologist is certainly involved in preventing disease, but much of this is the role of the general internist. It might be the role of nephrologist or a kidney specialist, too, so we do all work together. If someone is having an acute stroke, they're best off in the hands of a neurologist who's best equipped to manage that acutely. But after that stroke is over, the prevention of subsequent events might be best managed by a team of people. The neurologist and the internist, or the neurologist, the internist, and the cardiologist. And we all do preventive cardiovascular medicine from different perspectives. And working together, I think, is the key role here.
You know, the American Heart Association likes to say that it's had a great impact on heart disease and stroke in the United States. But if I go and look through the epidemiology textbooks and try to see what are the major killers, it still sounds to me like we're not there yet. What is the prevalence of this whole disease process?
You know, it's very interesting. Cardiovascular disease is still the leading cause of death in this country, but its rates have gone down. The problem is the incidence or the prevalence of the disease, meaning the number of people who have heart disease, continues to rise. we're doing a better job keeping people alive once they have heart disease. What we're not doing is a good job of preventing it from happening at all. And so, again, when you think about cardiovascular disease, it's great that you survived your stroke, but think of the cost of surviving a stroke and everything that goes along with it, financially, economically, emotionally, etc. So that, while again, we're preventing, in some sense, the end stage, which is death, we're not doing a good at the beginning of the disease or preventing its onset.
Why is it that we are, as Americans are just so fixed in our ways that we're going to keep smoking, eating bad foods? Or I mean, what do you think is happening?
Some things are improving. We do smoke less now than we used to. The problem is we're rapidly expanding. And when I say expanding, I mean at the waistline. And when you look at graphics of what's going on in this country from a perspective of weight, we're dramatically increasing our waist. We're dramatically increasing our weight. And these two things are driving one of the biggest epidemics health-wise in this world, which is that of diabetes. And it's increasing weight, obesity, and diabetes that's ultimately, I believe, leading to this increased incidence or prevalence of cardiovascular disease.
Again, you can't open a magazine and not see something about obesity and diabetes. How do they go hand in hand? What's going on there?
Well, diabetes occurs for a lot of different reasons. What we're seeing now is a tremendous expansion in the onset of type 2 diabetes. This is diabetes where people develop traditionally later on in life, and it's related to increased weight. We believe that what happens in these patients is because of obesity, and in particular abdominal obesity, girth around the midsection, what happens is different types of hormones are produced that alters the way the body responds to insulin. These patients make plenty of insulin, they just can't respond to it. It's like having a key that doesn't fit into the door. No matter how big the key is, it's not going to fit into the door, and so they make more insulin. And when you make too much insulin, it's actually bad for you, not good for you. Type 1 diabetes...
How is it bad for you?
Well, what happens is elevated levels of insulin, number one, increase our desire to eat. So we become heavier, which makes the cycle go forward even more. Elevated levels of insulin are almost like Velcro for cholesterol, meaning that for any given level of cholesterol, if you've got diabetes, it sticks to the blood vessel more. Number three, elevated levels of insulin alter the way our blood vessels interact with a variety of different other substances that pass through them, such that the endothelium, or the lining of the blood vessels, become unstable or abnormal. And so for a variety of different reasons, elevated insulin levels can be bad. Ultimately, if we make too much insulin over a long period of time, our pancreas burns out, and we don't make enough insulin anymore. And that's the end stage of diabetes, and that's when people need to be replaced with insulin.
Yeah, I thought I heard you refer to that your body starts to make other hormones that block the insulin.
Mm-hmm.
Which hormones are those?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. What happens as we gain weight, as we smoke, as we decide to become inactive, what happens is our body goes through a heightened state of oxidized stress, or oxidative stress.
What's that?
Oxidative stress is when we stress a variety of different molecules in our body to the point that they change the way they interact with other molecules. And they start to do damage to blood vessels, damage to the lining of blood vessels, damage to a variety of different substances that circulate throughout the body. In this situation, ultimately what happens is we start to develop an inflammatory process that is the basis for the development of heart disease or atherosclerosis. And we now know that atherosclerosis, which leads to cardiovascular disease, is not a stagnant or stable process. It's an inflammatory process, an irritative process. The linings of the blood vessels become annoyed and irritated, and this is the beginning of heart disease.
People hear that, you know, obesity is a problem even in our pediatric population. Are we seeing an increased incidence of diabetes, or is that a whole different process?
Well, we do see an increased amount of obesity in our children now. And what's interesting is type 2 diabetes, which used to be a disease of adults, has now become a disease of children. And we are seeing now an emerging and increasing rate of type 2 diabetes in adolescents and young children. And this is very disturbing because, again, diabetes, we believe, is one of the major factors in the generation of cardiovascular disease. So we're pushing the curve down now. And if this continues, we're going to see a drop in the age when we expect people to start develop heart disease because they're starting the process earlier now.
So you're telling me that the person that's just fat and they have this type 2 diabetes, they're making normal amounts of the insulin, which you need to not be fat. How do you treat them? I mean, it sounds like they've got a normal system. They're just fat. So what are you doing?
Well, the best thing that you can do, and study after study has shown this, is what we call lifestyle modification. No matter what drug you use, no matter what intervention you make, if you can get people to diet and exercise and lose weight and change the way they live, you can reverse the process of diabetes in many cases. It's a wonderful study that's been done. It's called the Diabetes Prevention Program, where they gave people a drug to treat diabetes. They gave them standard lifestyle modification, where they basically sent someone to live with them to teach them how to diet and eat right and exercise. And if you can guess which group did best, it's the group that had someone intervene with them. It's the intensive intervention that makes a difference. There are drugs that you can give people early on in the pre-diabetic or early diabetic process that can halt the process or help the patient reverse the process. But the longer you go, the more difficult it is to stop things.
What do you think about all these diet aids? You know, you can't open a People magazine or turn on the TV without seeing some new kind of a pill that's going to help you burn off 20 pounds in a week. Do they work?
I would say no. I would say that almost anything you see advertised on TV or in newspapers or in magazines is not something that's going to help you long-term lose weight and keep weight off. There are a few available products, pharmaceutical agents, approved by the FDA to help with weight loss, but they only help with weight loss. And ultimately, it's modification of lifestyle that determines how someone will do with regards to keeping weight off long term.
Is it your experience that overweight parents produce overweight children, and so it's a self-perpetuating thing, or is it sporadic?
It's both. We do certainly see an increased amount of obesity in children who come from family units where there is increased obesity. At the same time, the lifestyle that children are going through now is very different than that of their parents. When I was growing up, what we did when we went outside was we played. We were active. Kids don't do that as much anymore. They're home more. They're sitting in front of computers. They're doing less activities outside. And this change in lifestyle that we're seeing is certainly one of the other factors that's leading towards this.
So I guess I have to ask, is this one of the central statements then of the American Heart Association? Are they getting the band out there and saying, this is what you have to do for your children? Otherwise, as I would see it, we're creating a generation of people with significant health problems.
Well, the recommendations are for adults and for children that regular activity is important. End of story.
So characterize that regular activity for us a little bit. I mean, what should I do? I don't want to get overweight. What should I be doing?
The first thing is to move. Choose to move. That's one of the mantras of the American Heart Association for women, actually. But it's getting active in general. The next step is some increased physical activity on a regular basis, meaning jogging, walking fast, exerting yourself. At least 45 minutes, 4 to 5 days a week is what we need to do on a regular basis to keep weight off and stay physically fit and reduce the risk of heart disease.
We're going to have to take a short break. Please stay with us. I'm with Dr. James Underberg, the founder and president of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. He's going to tell us how to prevent heart attack and stroke. Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip E. Stieg, and I'm with Dr. James A. Underberg, Assistant Professor of Medicine at NYU Medical Center and founder and president of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. Before the break, we were talking about the link between obesity and diabetes, and we had to stop. Dr. Underberg, tell us how we can help our children avoid gaining weight, and as a matter of fact, how we can help ourselves. You want to get back into that?
Sure. Again, I think the most important thing, especially with young children, is establishing a pattern early of healthy lifestyle. That begins with regular activity, which means simply encouraging activities that are outside, that involve movement, that involve some degree of exertion. Children don't need to be involved in regular physical exertion programs. They don't need to be enrolled in gymnasiums. They don't need to have classes for this, but they need to be getting outside and playing and moving. As children get older, enrolling them in sports programs and things like that is certainly good, but dance or anything else that a child chooses to do that gets them outside and active, I think, is important. I think the other side of the coin, though, is diet and nutrition. And we live in a society now where everything is fast and everything is supersized, and that is particularly targeted towards kids. If you turn on the television today and you look at advertisements on TV, almost every fast food advertisement you see is targeted towards kids or families with kids. It's cheaper and it's easier. Look what's going on in New York City right now. The New York City Department of Health has actually mandated that restaurants stop cooking with dangerous trans fats. What is the reaction of these restaurants? Many of them say, it's too costly. My customers won't come in if I can't use the stuff. Everything gets back to the easiest and the simplest. So again, I think making dietary choices that are a little healthier for our children early on and getting them used to those tastes when they're young improves their compliance with that sort of dietary program later on in life.
I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I probably more than you are a baby boomer. You know, I decide now I'm going to go out and get ready for marathons. I mean, do people have to go that far to keep thin?
I don't think so. And in fact, I have patients who come in to see me all the time as they're getting ready to run the marathon. And the first thing I tell them is, I can find very little good medical benefits of running a marathon other than what it might do for you mentally if it makes you feel good to accomplish it. But it's a tremendous degree of abuse your body takes to run a marathon, prepare for a marathon, and train for a marathon. So if you like running and you like being active, I would tell you, run 5Ks. If you need to do that one marathon, that's fine. But people who run that much all the time run the risk of doing damage to their musculoskeletal system over a long period of time.
And I don't want every listener that's out there that's a little bit overweight and has diabetes feel like, gosh, I must be doing something wrong. Is it only environmental, or, you know, is there a genetic component to this?
There absolutely is a genetic component to it, and it's not just weight. It's waist circumference. It turns out that when we talk about fat, we talk about what we call visceral fat. That's not the fat that's right underneath your skin. That's the fat that lives inside your body. And in many people, you don't see that. There are some people, if you look at them, they look thin. But it turns out that they have a fair amount of fat in between their organs. And that fat may not translate into an increased body weight. It may not even translate into an increased waist circumference. And that may be genetically driven in some people. And again, that determines to a large extent how their body works metabolically to process things like sugars and cholesterol that ultimately drive some of the risk that causes cardiovascular disease.
Just before, you were referring to this concept of trans fats. You know, you can't turn on the TV and not see either an ad for Viagra or for Lipitor. And I presume by trans fats you're worried about lipids. I mean, what is a lipid?
Oh, it's interesting. Lipids are the constituents of what we normally determine or talk about as the cholesterol profile. So if someone comes in and wants to get their cholesterol checked, what we do is we check their cholesterol and their triglycerides. Cholesterol is a waxy substance. It's produced by the body and absorbed by the body, and it's used as a precursor for a lot of other things that we need, such as hormones. Triglycerides represent fat in the body, and those can either be broken down from fat stores in our fat tissue or, again, absorbed through the intestine when we eat. Triglycerides and cholesterol are what we call lipids. What's very interesting is that lipids don't float around in our bloodstream freely. They can only get from point A to point B in the body if they travel inside a vehicle, and those vehicles are called lipoproteins. And it's very important to understand the difference between lipids and lipoproteins, because most people don't get their lipoproteins measured. They only get their lipids measured. Again, if you imagine lipids as passengers in cars, and you imagine cars as the lipoproteins, and you think about what causes a traffic jam, it's the number of vehicles on the road, not the number of passengers driving in the vehicles. And the problem is, currently, most people, when they get their cholesterol checked, are just getting an information about the number of passengers and not the number of vehicles.
Are there new tests coming out that will help us with lipoproteins?
Well, there are new tests, and there are also tests that have been around for a while that we just don't use that much. One of them is a test called apoprotein B. And apoprotein B is like the license plate on a car. There's one for every car. There's one for every lipoprotein. And apoprotein B is a very inexpensive, widely available test that people can use. It can be measured, and it's another way of looking at cardiovascular risk separate from our traditional lipids. Now, lipids are valuable, and they're useful, and they've served us well for a long time. The problem is they don't get us all the way there. And everyone's heard the story about Uncle Joe or Aunt Susie whose cholesterol was great, and she had a heart attack, or he had a heart attack. Well, why does that happen? It's because lipids aren't the end-all and be-all. And it turns out that it's not the lipids that are interacting with the wall of our blood vessel. It's the lipoproteins.
So do we need to be telling our listeners that they have to make sure with their family practitioner they're getting the apoproteins test, or has it become part of the routine armamentarium now?
I would tell you that it's probably not needed yet as a routine screening test. But in people who are at increased risk for cardiovascular disease, people who have family history, people who have other risk factors for heart disease, or in situations where they have low levels of the good HDL cholesterol or high levels of triglycerides or fats, it's probably very important to think about looking at the apolipoproteins.
But based on what you were saying earlier in terms of prevalence, wouldn't that be the majority of the society?
Well, right now it's becoming that. And certainly it's an area that is being looked at more and more by people like myself who do this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Some businesses are, I think, ripping off the public in terms of, you know, the labels on their packages. And, you know, what's a good lipid? What's a bad lipid? A good triglyceride? A bad trans fat? I mean, you know, we're being bombarded with this stuff. I mean, how do I go to the grocery store and just protect myself?
You know, there is some basic information available, I think, that's very useful when we read labels. I think the first thing to do is to look at the fat content in general. The second thing is to look at the type of fat. In general, it's better to stay with the poly and monounsaturated fats and avoid the saturated fats. But if there are going to be fats, the one thing you really want to avoid are the trans fats. Trans fats are artificial fats. It's kind of like throwing a screwdriver into a gear shaft. It just jams things up and it doesn't go anywhere. And it stops the normal metabolic processes from happening in our body. And that's why trans fats, basically and simply, are not good for us. They taste good, they're cheap, and they're easy to cook with, which is why a lot of people use them. But it's better to stick with the mono and polyunsaturated fats. The next thing people need to look at is sugar content and carbohydrate. It's good to avoid high sugar foods. Why? Because sugar can get converted into fat. At the same time, carbohydrates can get converted into sugar. So if you're looking for foods, lower sugar content, lower carbohydrate, very good for you. That means stay away from the white stuff, the white rice, the white bread, the white pasta. It's better to stick with the whole wheats, the whole grains, brown rice, whole wheat pasta, etc. Finally, there's cholesterol, and that information is on the label too. And we can look at total cholesterol. It's probably good to limit your cholesterol to about 300 milligrams a day. Beyond that, there's probably not that much more information on that label that people are going to find useful. But that's a fair amount of information, I think.
Well, for me, that's just, I'm not overweight, but one of the issues for me is I go and I look and I see, it's only got 9%. What's 9%? That means I got another 91 to go for the rest of the day.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, how do we handle that stuff?
Well, I think it's better to get away from the percent and look at the grams per serving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things a lot of people do is they don't realize how much they're eating. What is a serving? And if you start to read what a serving is, and then it tells you what the grams or the amount per serving is, it makes it a lot easier to figure out how much you're actually getting. Again, I think it's important to limit the overall amount of food we eat also. And that's one of the biggest problems we have. I mean, if you ask me simply, what's the best thing we can do as a country, it's to eat less. If people just ate less in general, things would be a lot easier.
And, I mean, let's face it, one of the other problems in America is we've got too much smoking and too much drinking. Is it a cumulative effect? And what about red wines? Are they better for you?
Well, let's start with the cigarette smoking first, or smoking in general. I'll tell you one quick story. A patient of mine, gentleman in his mid-50s, had high blood pressure and high cholesterol. We had controlled everything perfectly. His cholesterol was low. His blood pressure was low. He was taking an aspirin a day. He had had a stress test that was normal, but the only thing we couldn't get him to do was to stop smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. Well, one day I got a call. He was in the emergency room with a horrible heart attack, and that's because cigarette smoking is a very big hill to climb up over, and if we can get people to stop smoking, it's one of the best and most powerful reducers of cardiovascular disease there is available to us. And we have done a good job, I think, at reducing the number of people who do smoke, but it is still a very significant risk factor, both primary smoking and even secondary exposure to smoke. I still see mothers walking around the city smoking cigarettes, pushing babies in a stroller, and it just drives me nuts. Moving over to alcohol, most studies have shown that a small amount of alcohol intake is probably good for us. It's unclear whether one type of alcohol is better than the other. There have been studies done with beer, there have been studies done with liquor, and there have been studies done with wine. There's some suggestion that some of the products in red wine or in grapes mixed with alcohol have what we call, and what we spoke about earlier, an antioxidant effect or an anti-inflammatory effect. It turns also to be that alcohol raises levels of the good HDL cholesterol. HDL I call the happy cholesterol, and it has, to somewhat extent, a cardiovascular protective effect, although not in everyone. And so, while moderate amounts of alcohol may actually have a cardioprotective effect, I would never tell someone who doesn't drink to go out and start drinking for beneficial reasons.
So, based on the numbers you were talking about earlier, it sounds to me like probably most people do have some problem with their lipids and their cholesterol. What are my chances, if I have that, of just controlling it with activity and diet?
Well, again, I think a lot depends on the causes. For many of us, our cholesterol issues are genetic. Just like that commercial on TV, it's Uncle Sam and Aunt June who drive to a large extent where our cholesterol is. One of the important things to understand is that when we eat and consume cholesterol, only about 20%, maybe even less, of our body's cholesterol actually comes from absorbing food in the intestine. And the majority of cholesterol is actually made in our liver. And so even the best person under ideal circumstances could probably only lower their cholesterol about 15 to 20% with dietary measures. And that's in the best of circumstances. So the reality is, if someone has a very, very high cholesterol, and if they're not significantly overweight or obese or have diabetes, it's unlikely that dietary changes alone are going to lower their cholesterol levels to the numbers where they need to be.
So I turn on a couple different radio stations, a couple different TV stations, and I hear about, you know, 3 to 6 different lipid-lowering drugs. Is there a difference? And then what's the downside of taking these things?
Well, the drug companies would love me to tell you that there is. One of the problems is that there are no studies comparing any drug to another drug and looking to see who lives longer, who has fewer heart attacks, or who has fewer strokes. There's lots of information that X drug does Y and Z drug does A, but it's hard to take that and translate it into patient outcomes. The one really nice thing that I would say about practicing preventive cardiovascular medicine today is we've got a ton of great medicines that make it easy to find the right one for a particular patient. And there are subtle differences between all these drugs. There are interactions with other medications. There are differences in the way they're processed by the kidney or the liver, such that what might be the right drug for one person might not be the right drug for another person. I just had a situation recently where I had two young men who worked together, and they both came in to see me one after the other, and both needed to be on lipid-lowering drugs. And when the second one came in, he wanted to know why I was giving him a different drug at a different dose than the first gentleman. And I said, because you're different people. In different circumstances, you need different medications. And that's the reality of it, but the nice thing is we do have options, and it makes it easier.
So, you put me on Lipitor. Anything bad happen?
Well, there are side effects of these medications, which is why they're not, quote, in the drinking water.
Yeah.
You know, they do things. Sometimes they can cause problems with the muscles, problems with the liver, problems with the kidneys. So we try not to use them unless the benefits of the drug outweigh the potential risks of the drug. So how we decide who takes these medicines is on whether or not they will benefit from using them to reduce their risk of heart attack and stroke. We don't take these drugs to just lower the numbers. We take the drugs to reduce the risk of disease. And that's what people have to remember, that the drugs reduce the risk of having these horrible things happen. And that's why I think they're good medications when used properly.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but in terms of the lipids and cholesterol, again, your general nutrition centers have these cabinets filled with alternative forms of medication, and then there's the whole herboreal movement and that. Help the listeners understand what's good, and I certainly don't want them to hurt themselves. What should they avoid?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the first things people have to understand is that just because something's available over the counter or as a supplement or in a vitamin store, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe or that it doesn't interact with other medicines, or it might not have other deleterious issues that they have to be concerned about or worried about. The problem is that a lot of these medications have not been investigated, examined, or looked at as to how they interact with medications someone might be taking. So the first thing that I tell patients is if they want to pursue a more alternative or herbal approach, get the assistance of someone who is an expert in that. And there are people who do this. We have a wonderful field that's developing. I work with a friend and colleague who I trained with in medical school who's a specialist in the area of integrative medicine. Integrative medicine does exactly what it says. They integrate traditional medicine with more alternative forms of medicine, but they do it in a scientific and evidence-based manner, meaning based on what's available in the literature that we know does good things and bad things. Best example I can come up with is that many people don't like to take the statin or cholesterol medicines, but they prefer to take the over-the-counter or supplement called red rice yeast extract. Well, it turns out that this is just a naturally occurring version of statin medications, and it has almost the exact same side effect profile as the prescription drugs, including the fact that it might cause birth defects in the children of pregnant women. So, again, a woman who was taking this medicine, if they didn't read the label carefully, wouldn't know that it might have significant side effects if they were pregnant. It's not a prescription medicine. It's not regulated by the FDA. So I tell people, get the advice of your physician. If your physician isn't comfortable with these types of products, get the advice of someone who is. And there are plenty of good people out there who do this.
We have to take a short break. Please stay with us. I'm with Dr. James Underberg, and he's going to expand for us on how to save your life with medications and exercise. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip E. Stieg, and I'm again with Dr. James Underberg, the founder and president of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. And before we left, we were talking about alternative medicines for controlling your cholesterol, lipids, and also a new area of medicine called integrative medicine. I wanted to expand on that. Can you tell us what that is?
Again, integrative medicine is an emerging specialty of physicians who are interested in both traditional methods of medicine and what you might consider more non-traditional or alternative methods of medicine. But the key is the interweaving or mixing of the two together, not eschewing one for the other. And I think that's the key and important approach to this, is that there are plenty of wonderful things that have been established to work in traditional medicine, yet sometimes people want to pursue other options. And if that's going to be done, I think it should be done with the help and guidance of someone who understands the risks and benefits of some of these alternative therapies. Because just like traditional medications, alternative therapy carries benefits and risks. And it's important to understand these. Working with someone who can understand the way these interweave, I think, can be a good approach for someone who wants to pursue that.
Unfortunately, we all know and have experiences with people that have gotten taken in by somebody that decided to open up a shop and do what you're describing. How do they protect themselves? Where can they Google and find out, you know, is this a reliable person? What direction should I go in?
Well, I think the key thing is to make sure, number one, that you're starting out with someone who is a physician, either an MD or a DO, doctor of osteopathy or a doctor of medicine, someone who's trained in medicine, who has then done additional training in integrative medicine. There's a fellowship that people can do. They can become board certified in integrative medicine. There's a website that you can look for to find these people. Many of them exist at academic medical centers, and it's increasing in prevalence throughout the medical profession. So there are ways to identify and find them. People might ask their regular doctor, do you know anyone I can go to who you trust, who you can work with, so that we can all work together? It's not either or if someone wants to pursue that. It doesn't mean that everyone has to feel pushed to go in that direction, but if a patient chooses to look in that direction, they should do it with some guidance.
I wanted to switch pages here quickly and get into another area that you're a considerable expert in, and that's hypertension. And how does that link, or how is that linked to elevated cholesterol and lipids? And technically speaking, what is hypertension?
Well, that's still an area up for discussion, too. And in fact, the American Society of Hypertension has recently made an effort to redefine the way we think about high blood pressure, which is what hypertension is. Traditionally, we define high blood pressure as blood pressure greater than 140 over 90. 140, that top number, is the systolic blood pressure, and the bottom number is the diastolic blood pressure. But it turns out that for different people, different numbers might apply. And in fact, someone who has increased risk for cardiovascular disease, someone who's already had a stroke or a heart attack, or someone who, say, has type 2 diabetes, normal blood pressure for them is actually lower, say in the area of 130 over 80 or even 120 over 70. So blood pressure is starting to become something in flux, and we think about it in the context of the other risk factors that someone has. And you brought up the concept of cholesterol, and it turns out that cholesterol, or lipids, and blood pressure are linked very closely. And if you look at people who develop high blood pressure, more often than not, they have problems with their cholesterol. And people who have high blood pressure and high cholesterol, the two work synergistically to cause cardiovascular disease. And in fact, the person who has very high blood pressure and normal cholesterol, or the person who has very high cholesterol and normal blood pressure, is at probably almost the same risk as the person has only mild blood pressure problems and only mild cholesterol problems. The two are not additive, they're multiplicative.
We didn't mention this earlier. You brought it up a little bit earlier that everybody should be taking one aspirin a day. Does aspirin have an impact on the hypertension or an impact on the lipids, or how does it protect us?
Well, it doesn't necessarily lower blood pressure or reduce cholesterol levels, but what aspirin does do in people who are at increased risk for heart disease or stroke is reduce the likelihood that they will have a heart attack or stroke. Now, it turns out that men and women behave differently. and that aspirin is much better at preventing stroke in women, and it's much better at preventing heart attacks in men. Which gets to one of the more interesting things that I like to talk about, which is that men and women are different. I don't think I'm telling you anything that's not ultimately obvious.
Okay. You want to expand on how are they different then in regard to hypertension and their lipid profiles?
Well, one of the things we do know is that men and women present and develop with heart disease differently. We know that, for instance, as women get older, they actually bypass men and develop heart disease at greater rates than men do. But traditionally, we tend to think of women as having a lower risk for heart disease than men, and that's wrong. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that women get underdiagnosed and undertreated for cardiovascular disease risk. And that's because we as a society, don't think of women as potentially being at increased risk for heart disease. We're very good about thinking about things like ovarian cancer and breast cancer, but heart disease is still the number one cause of death in women. On top of that, though, women tend to do things a little differently than men do. And it turns out that while men develop heart disease from what we would describe as an occlusive perspective, meaning that clot starts to form in the arteries and works its way inward, so that if you took a picture at the inside of an artery in a man with heart disease, you might see the development of an obstruction. It turns out that women develop their plaque or their atherosclerotic disease on the outside of the artery, such that it almost encases the artery and makes it stiffer. For this reason, many times women who come to the emergency room with chest pain or have symptoms of cardiovascular disease, when they get tested with a stress test or even something called a catheterization where we look inside their arteries with dye, everything looks normal. And many times they're told there's nothing wrong with you, go home. Well, it's because these traditional tests that are used to looking for heart disease in men don't do as good a job at finding the way it develops in women. And that's one of the issues that we're dealing with right now.
When do we start needing to go to the doctor regularly to have our blood pressure monitored, or should we run down to the local drugstore and have it checked? What do you think is best? What do you advise your patients?
Well, the U.S. Preventative Task Force recommends that beginning at age 18, we have our blood pressure checked probably every 2 years. And the American Heart Association, American College of Family Physicians pretty much agree with that. So I think at minimum, beginning at age 18, every 2 years, if the blood pressure is in the upper end of the normal range, then people should probably have their blood pressure checked every year. And that's because people who fall into the upper level of the normal range of blood pressure actually fall into a new category called prehypertension. People with prehypertension are more likely to develop high blood pressure over the course of their lives. They need to be followed closer, and they're also at increased risk for developing diabetes and having abnormal cholesterol. These run in packs. And if you find one, you got to look for the others.
And do they respond well to medication?
They do. Blood pressure in general responds very well to medication. The average person who develops high blood pressure will probably need 2 to 3 medications, however, to control their blood pressure. So it's not easy to treat. It's better if we try to prevent it. And preventing the development of high blood pressure is one of the reasons that we developed this new term, prehypertension. Because it turns out that if we institute the same risk factor modifications that we do for diabetes, diet and exercise, eating right, being active, losing weight, we can prevent the development of hypertension.
In this area, I haven't heard about as much here as I have in obesity and that, but are there over-the-counter supplements that people will try to control their blood pressure? Is it as prevalent there?
Probably not as prevalent because high blood pressure is an asymptomatic disease. Many people don't even know they have it until they go to the doctor and get their blood pressure checked, or they go to the pharmacy, or they go to a health fair. And people feel well, so many times they say, why should I even do anything, especially if nothing's bothering me right now. There are some non-traditional methods that have been shown to lower blood pressure. Certainly stress does cause increases in blood pressure, but it doesn't cause hypertension per se. And some people look for things like biofeedback. And certainly, as I said, diet, low-sodium diets that are rich in grains and vegetables and lower in saturated fats also lower blood pressure. So there are lots of things people can do besides taking medications, but in many cases, hypertension, again, is genetically driven. And there are some people, despite doing everything right, develop hypertension and need to be treated with medication.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to my next question, and that is, can you control it, with meditation and stress modifiers in your life?
Well, again, I think that it may help. What happens with most people, though, is that blood pressure is a set point. Our blood pressure lives in general in a certain range. And things like stress, anger, anxiety can move us up or down if we're relaxed, say, within that range. But it's where are we starting from? And that's what tends to be more determined in what we treat when we try to lower blood pressure, is that set point. What we're moving to, though, is instead of looking at one reading of blood pressure in an office, is what is the blood pressure doing when someone is not with the doctor? What's it doing at home? We're encouraging people to do home blood pressure monitoring or doing testing now called ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, where we look at someone's blood pressure over a 24-hour period. That's a much more accurate way, I believe, of getting a picture as to whether someone has high blood pressure or whether it's just high because they're in the doctor's office and a little nervous.
You also mentioned that there was a difference between boys and girls. And I note also that you're extremely interested in menopause. Now, is menopause directly linked to your cholesterol and lipid levels and your hypertension? And if so, how?
It's a loaded question, but I wouldn't say that the menopause causes these abnormalities. And one of the first things I always like to explain about menopause is it's like a very small town. Don't blink or you might miss it. The menopause is the period that lasts for 1 year after a woman's last menstrual period. So by the time you've had that, you're out of menopause and you're then postmenopausal. It turns out that as women move through the menopause, though, the way their body responds and modulates blood pressure changes. And so what happens is some of the medications that we might use to treat high blood pressure in women who are premenopausal are different from the types of medications we might use when they're postmenopausal. And understanding how the menopause influences blood pressure, I think, is important in the management of cardiovascular risk in these women. Cholesterol also changes a little bit. Women tend to absorb certain types of cholesterol more from their intestine after the menopause as opposed to before the menopause. Now, this may be related just to lower levels of estrogen. However, we do know from many good studies that simply replacing estrogen is not the way to go to prevent cardiovascular disease. And even within the context of postmenopause, it turns out that younger postmenopausal women behave differently than older postmenopausal women. And some studies of estrogen replacement, as an example, have shown that if you give estrogen early on to younger perimenopausal women, early on in the process, it might indeed have a protective cardiovascular effect. But if you give it to older women, 20, 30 years after the menopause, it clearly has a negative cardiovascular effect. So all is not black and white when it comes to this concept, and it's an emerging and interesting area of medicine.
Okay. I'm a physician. You've confused me. I'm a, 50-year-old woman coming in. Think I had my last period 3 months ago. What are you going to advise to me?
Now, the first thing I would say is that the use of estrogen right now is indicated for really one thing, and that's to treat menopausal symptoms. That means that if you're having hot flashes, if you're not sleeping at night, if you're not feeling right, estrogen can be used to control those symptoms. And there are very few reasons that a woman should be denied that if they feel that it's really altering their lifestyle to the point where they're not happy. There are ways that estrogen, however, can be used safely and appropriately, and that's to use it short-term, early on, and monitor the patient closely. Now, there are contraindications or reasons why people shouldn't be on supplemental estrogen therapy. People who smoke, possibly, increased risk of what we call thromboembolic disease. People with breast cancer.
By thromboembolic disease, you mean what, blood clots?
I mean blood clots in the legs, history of stroke in the brain, clots in the heart, etc.
Yeah.
People with certain types of gynecologic cancers, breast cancers, ovarian cancers, cancers that respond to estrogen. Clearly, these are the people you wouldn't rush to put on estrogen therapy. But in people who don't have reasons to not use it, the reason to use it is if they're having menopausal symptoms. Right now, we do not use it to prevent cardiovascular disease, to prevent dementia or Alzheimer's disease.
Is there an increased incidence or prevalence of hypertension in menopausal women?
No, there's not. But as women get older, they do develop hypertension at the same rate that everyone else does, but the way they develop it is a little different than the way men develop it.
Yeah, I'm really curious. You've really kind of helped create an innovative field of medicine with this whole preventive cardiovascular society, and then your interest in its relationship with menopausal women. How did you fall into this?
Well, you know, my background is in general medicine. I was always very interested in cardiology, but I'm not a procedure guy. I do well at home working with carpentry, etc., but I knew that my best procedure was my brain, and I like problem solving. And it always seemed to me that the two leading causes of death in this country were cancer and heart disease. If you could prevent those, you were doing a pretty good job taking care of people. As I started to go into my practice, the emerging field of cardiovascular prevention was becoming proactive. We were developing drugs that could make a difference on the way people develop these diseases, such that you might be able to prevent death and prolong life and prolong quality of life. And to me, that was fascinating. So the ability to integrate prevention, hypertension, cholesterol, made a lot of sense to me. Now, in my mind, 50% of that population is women. So if you don't understand how the menopause affects cardiovascular disease in women, you're removing a large part of the patients that you can, I think, appropriately and effectively take care of.
You want to leave the listeners with one final message. What is that?
I think that it is to make an effort to improve the lifestyle and the activity level and your ability to consume and eat the right foods in the context of understanding your own cardiovascular risk. And you can do that in conjunction, I think, with a very simple and easy consultation with a general practitioner who understands these concepts.
Thank you again to Dr. James A. Underberg, Assistant Professor of Medicine at NYU Medical Center and President of the New York Preventive Cardiovascular Society. Dr. Underberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.